Good?
Oui.
All right, so my name is Jean-Philippe. I'll be just giving a little overview of the political situation before Rob gives his class on parts of the history of Canada. But before, maybe it's not everyone who knows, but LaRouche recently gave an address in Berlin, September 6th. And we made a pamphlet out of it, which is called The End of the Truman Era, referring to Harry Truman, former president of the United States, right after Franklin Roosevelt. And he starts his presentation by explaining, relating when he was in World War II in India, a city named Burma, where he actually attended different mass rally, different demonstrations against the British occupation. You know, all this political ferment around Gandhi. And he saw this enormous mobilization by British, basically trying to kill as many people as possible, just getting in there and, you know, breaking everyone's face, killing people. And this is the sense that LaRouche had of the idea of imperialism, that actually the fight against the Nazis was not just a fight, as Roosevelt had defined, wasn't just a fight against anti-Semitism, but was a far bigger fight. It was a fight for you to save nation-state, just like the group around Gandhi were fighting for. And at a certain point, there's an event that LaRouche relates. He related it many times. Is the event when Franklin Roosevelt died, and he was in India, and many soldiers went to see him, because LaRouche already at the time was involved a lot politically. Would even go talk to Indian political parties, Indian social group and stuff. So people ask LaRouche, you know, what do you think about the death of Franklin Roosevelt? And LaRouche says, this is very, very bad news. And a very great man was replaced by a very small man, which was Harry Truman. And when people think about Harry Truman, one thing that they think about is Nagasaki, Hiroshima, which was not really his policy. But when after Roosevelt died, he had this intention to really bring back this idea of empire, that the fact that the Nazis would have died would not have given rise to economic development, as Franklin Roosevelt was talking about. So he had basically a situation where, you know, the Cold War, where people tend to become extremely scared by politics, right? Baby boomer generation were really affected by that, for example. But that's when you had a huge movement towards, you know, the suburb, people coming back from war, saying, okay, that's it, I did my job, and let's have some kids, let's have a house, let's have a dog, but let's not shake too much ground. Let's stay quiet and calm. And basically politics starts being driven by fear. You know, if you have any link with some other party which is not Democrat or Republican, you become some type of threat. And this is being used actually to actually prevent people from getting involved in politics. Today, I would say there's things that are very similar, and I'm going to get into that, on this idea of war propaganda. Because people have to get a sense that in these time of crises, the ideas that are being spread out, I mean, you have to be able to get at the intention behind those facts and those news. Yeah, I'm gonna skip a little part, but I mean, it's important in order to know where we are in history, and because during the LaRouche's webcast, we actually had not just the webcast, but there was a whole week of action in D.C. And one of the things that we put out as a because every time we have these weeks of action, the idea is to go and to just spread the whole city with literature, get a lot of contacts through City Congress, and have different types of intervention. And we had this leaflet titled LaRouche to Rumsfeld, FDR defeated the Nazis while Bush's collaborated. And this was an answer to an attack made by Rumsfeld in three occasions. We had a during two press conferences and one editorial in the Los Angeles Times, where basically attacked the Democrats as being appeasers, relating to the people that basically were not willing to fight the Nazis at the time. So if you're against the war, you're a Nazi or a fascist appeaser. And but the real issue is that actually, well, who put an end to the Nazis? No, it's not some type of Dr. Strangelove guy who says, I gotta bomb these guys. It was actually people like FDR, whose intention was to bring in development and to prevent the spread of that fascist tendencies. And what we go through in the leaflet is actually the fact that people like Prescott Bush, who's the grandfather of the actual U.S. president. And by the way, this is stuff we published in 1992, so is it that we have to use it today. And it basically explains how people like Prescott Bush, under the bank called Union Banking Association, would be part of those networks financing the Nazis and giving them, you know, iron, steel for their Nazi war machine. And the Union Banking Association were seized, their offices were seized in 1942 under the Treating with the Enemy Act. Right? So here you have, right, the actual, you know, Islamo-fascist fighter George Bush, whose family was actually financing the Nazis at the time. And this was put out in order to give a chance to those poor fellow Democrats who, you know, whether they're baby boomers or just very old and getting senile, they have lost the sense to fight. This is something that happens usually when you have a very bad culture. And so we got this out in D.C. We're talking about maybe 30,000-40,000 copies of that. But you have other things as well, and I think the main propaganda that you had, I mean, Rumsfeld, that's one thing. There's an attack which you need a response to. If you don't respond to that, basically show that you're capitulating. And the other thing is this report, this documentary that maybe people have heard about, that there was a broadcast on ABC TV, which was called The Path to 9/11, which is a docudrama. So they have these so-called real facts, and they put real actors like Harvey Keitel and big guys. And the main idea of the documentary was to show how the Clinton administration and all those Democrats before were the real cause of 9/11, because they didn't do this, they didn't do that. And when you look into who produced this documentary, which was produced in part by Walt Disney, but that's there's this group, funny, you have this different idea of Mickey Mouse after that. But you have this group named Youth with a Mission, who, by the way, has an office in Montreal, if people want to go take a look. But it's basically a cult, or a Christian cult. And if you go on their website, it's all this idea of spirituality, you know, knowing God and shit. But who's actually is coming from... I'm gonna give you another example of that type of problem, but that this group actually is coming from another group called Moral Rearmament, who was a group in the 30s who actually were supporting Hitler, right? And the people, like one of the scripters, how do you say it?
Scriptwriter,
whose name is Cyrus Naurasti. Maybe I just... Well, I don't think you'll see that. You might see that in a co-production with Mel Gibson or something. You might see this name. So I'll put it just in case. No, Raste. Raste. Who's directly linked with those people, who's one of his, the leader of the Youth with a Mission, named David Cunningham. It's actually kind of a, not the protege, but the mentor of that person. And the problem is that this movie is actually going to be distributed freely 100,000 copies of it will be distributed in high schools.
Elementary schools too.
Schools, yeah, shit.
Which
yeah,
elementary
schools
too.
Okay.
High schools and elementary schools.
Which
school?
Path.
9/11. And Scholastic has actually written the study guide for the Harry Potter book publisher.
Yeah, so.
Sorry. So then you see, right? You see there's a. Yeah, it's war propaganda, right? And knowing the youth. I have an example in my head, but I want to keep it for later. This is a very nice one. So that's I think the main problem that we get in terms of war propaganda. Also, you're going to get different speeches, as you might know. I haven't much on Bush's speech on 9/11, but what I have is that what he had is in Israel, a guy named Benjamin Netanyahu. Because people might know that right now in Israel you might get new elections because there's a lot of discontent about the results of the war. Because the Israelis were just, you know, kicked everywhere. They lost poorly, like they didn't even fight, they were just kicked here and there. And there's a lot of discontent, so you might get new elections. So Netanyahu, who was a former prime minister, is now on the election mode. And one of the first things that he said is that he says, well, basically compared the Iranian regime to Hitler, saying that the Nazis started invading and then they looked for the nuclear bomb. But Iran, it's worse because they're looking for the nuclear bomb first, right? And he goes into that and he says basically that we're lucky that Al-Qaeda didn't have a nuclear bomb. Because otherwise they would have wiped out Manhattan, right? So this very scary speech made by someone you would think, you know, prime minister candidate must have some link with reality. But that's the type of propaganda we have to deal with, especially when we organize, right? Because when you organize, you see these emotional response like we saw during the war during Lebanon. Where people are having a hard time to, you know, kind of calm down and think about it, because, you know, it involves their family. People get depressed, you know, because the say human beings are such and such, they're crazy, they keep doing wars. So we kind of have to get these people out of their depression, in a sense. But also people, as we heard. Some people missed it, but we heard some news about the economic situation. Because you got to think about why are these people pushing for war like that? There's always, people can see different wars being triggered here and there in history, but you have certain moments where the dynamic is a war dynamic. That even if the Lebanon war is over, people have a sense that something, right, like Netanyahu or Cheney, are looking for another. Like right away, looking for another opening to create another war, because you have a financial system which is collapsing. You have a situation where nations want to reorganize themselves. The reason why LaRouche goes, to Berlin, D.C., to make sure that he can talk with the leadership to bring in a solution that these guys don't necessarily have, right? And especially a type of courage that these people need, because you have very important people from the IMF. Like I forget his name, but the IMF president, I think it's Ricardo Grado. Or you have the Secretary of Treasury of the United States, his name is Henry Paulson, who will actually admit that there's a financial crisis, but he will blame it on something, you know, like interest rates or
such. Medicare.
I'm sorry?
Medicare.
Yeah, like too much spending. But the thing is that they admit that there's a crisis, right? Whatever their reason is that they say, okay, we know it's pretty bad, right? And if you look also at the situation with the production, right? When we had this announcement about the Ford company, which says they're going to basically buy out 75,000 workers, like offering early retirement, and like to hopefully get the bonds or the shares to go up. but to get the production completely down. And LaRouche and our movement, we published extensively about how we can use this potential, the auto industry, not to produce necessarily more cars, but to go towards a retooling in order to build the to make sure we can sustain the needs for the future. I'm talking about like trains, subway system, nuclear power plants, talking about dams, you know, and other things like that. Just things that these guys can produce, but if you lose that, there's no, you don't have any chance to really build anything. Because you see, if people don't have a sense of where they are in the history, or what's really going on now, not only people miss many things, right? They might miss many events, but we have to ask ourselves, you know, okay, if we're, you know, okay, you have the LaRouche movement, they're thinking about changing things, but how are they going to do it? And you know, if even you have people from the IMF and the US government saying there's a financial collapse, why aren't these guys necessarily acting to change all this? That's why I wanted to bring my example, because the other day at UCAM, we were organizing on the street, and you had people from political science that were there, and you know, they were asking people for money because they were being initiated, and it was fun because we could use that with other people, basically telling people, let's say, because you know, they're asking for money, they're making fools of themselves, but they're also always thinking, say, hey, tonight, you know, vodka, gin. Right, they're already imagining themselves, you know, walking four legs and puking in their friends. So you'd use that as a pedagogical to other people, saying, look, this is your future leadership if you don't help us out. Right? Just, and you could actually get closer to them, just listen to what they were saying. And you know, just, it's almost tragic. And Val and myself vetted the idea to go talk with some of these people, you know, about the reality, and of course they felt a bit guilty of, you know, like I said to one of those guys, I say, hey, you know that the population is expecting a lot from people in political science. He goes, yes, right? He knows, he's not that idiot. And then you start briefing him, and also you brief him about, you know, the fact that a lot of political parties will actually make, you know, barbecues, parties, but they will never really address the actual crisis. And then you just look at them seriously, and they understand that there's a problem in what they're doing. Like, you just bring a certain idea of truth to them, like they're in a little bubble having a party, and you get some saner reaction. Right? But this is the type of problem we're dealing into, that you have youth that are being told, okay, it's okay to be completely rational, you're young. Right, you're 40 years old, yeah, it's still okay, you can be completely rational, that's fine. Right? And like today we were at Université de Montréal, and you know, first thing you know, we're organizing inside, and at around 3:15, you get these guys who start moving the furniture out, say, hey, what the hell's going on? Oh, the whole floor is going to be a huge party, right, because it's now like the first day of school or something. And you had two tents outside, it's like $1 of vodka and shit like that.
The lights.
Yeah, the lights were, how do you call that?
Black lights.
Fluorine.
Yeah. So hey, and that's like your future elite. Okay, you can say, okay, they won't get drunk every day, but that gives you an idea. And, you know, since people here are mostly youth, I mean, I have to tell you that sometimes people, they always say, I gotta study, but, you know, we know better. So. And there were two, I think, during our week of action, there were two events that will reflect a bit this idea of real politics. Because, you know, we're going to deal with a lot of things these coming days, and people saw the event at Dawson, for example, that are the type of events that, you know, have a certain impact on the culture. And on people's mind, right? Not just, you had this freak out. We had people in Dawson and Concordia, where you had most of the people were gathered in Concordia, and get this like insane excitement. People, they don't know where to go. They say a bunch of crazy things. But as leaders of a nation, you got to be able to bring these people back into the reality. They're saying, okay, let's rationalize all this and let's see how we can prevent these type of things from happening. Just like we have to look at the war, all those wars in Southwest Asia, Iraq, Afghanistan, and see how we can approach that. What you see in the population, and as we saw at the speech of the former Iranian president named Mohammad Khatami, who was in Washington, D.C., and it's pretty important because it was the first time since 1979 that you had a former or a head of state of Iran that could come to the United States. Right, during probably the worst U.S. administration ever. Right, the most like anti-Iran vice president ever. So you get this guy who's there and he's giving a presentation in the U.S. National Cathedral. We didn't attend, but we were outside talking to the people waiting in line. We had a lot of people from think tanks, diplomats, students, embassies and stuff like that. And one of the things that we would talk to them about, which was mentioned in LaRouche's webcast many times, is this question of the Treaty of Westphalia, which was this treaty which put an end to the 30 years war against the Catholic and the Protestant in Europe in the 17th century. And it's funny because a lot of people, they knew about that. They heard the name, you know, they all in foreign affairs or international affairs, so they heard the name. It's common. It's a common word for them. But when you ask them, can we do that? Can we really implement, again, a new treaty? Because this treaty was important in the sense that it mentioned that every nation had to start taking care of the advantage of the other. Instead of having this idea of might is right, that it's war against terrorism, well, then you had to basically like love thy neighbor. Right? Imagine the United States like developing Iran, or Israel really helping out Palestine. And when you ask them if it can be done, people look at you as a, right? So no way. And you can try, right? You can try. Right? And we had, the funny thing is that we had these signs, right, where we had a picture of the famous Oslo Accord Agreement, where you had the Clinton, Arafat, and Yitzhak Rabin, right? The Palestinian leader and the Israeli leader had signed another treaty, the Oslo Accord. It's a very nice picture because it shows you that you have three people that are not the best in the world, but actually responded to the crisis. Like whatever their mistake, they actually did an historical act, and would show people and say, "Hey, you remember this in the 90s? It worked. It actually happened." They say, "Oh yeah, okay, right." Then you would talk to them about LaRouche's policies and they would take some lips. Some of them left their phone numbers. But they didn't realize where they were actually. They didn't realize that, you know, you had the former Iranian president that were there and that we actually had to stop a war. They were there, you know, going to listen to his speech. And the funny thing, and that's where you got to think about the LaRouche Youth Movement method of organizing, because in front of that, you had this huge group was screaming, you know, Khatami, get out, people like anti-Iran. And they were promoting some other guy, Reza or something, you know, this idea basically of bringing democracy in Iran. Right? Same George Bush line, but promoted by some Iranians. Right? And the funny thing is that we managed actually to have contacts on both sides. We would actually go see these supposedly crazies and start just talking to them, say, "Hey, look, here's the situation. Right? This is a financial collapse. Bush doesn't want peace. You know, what's good for Iran? Well, here are some development projects. Right? Here's what happened in Iraq. Here's why we shouldn't trust people like Bush." You get like one or two crazies, but actually a lot of people that responded pretty rationally. They say, "Hey, that sounds good. Let me leave you my name." Right? And they start, you know, start criticizing Khatami for another half hour and say, "Hey, come, let's talk about real stuff." And then you bring them back to reality, and you know, So actually, you're going to get contacts from people who supposedly are for Academy, but they're just, you know, like, they just happen to be there to have a ticket. And these other people who seem to be against it, but actually, if you organize them, you actually see that there's a human soul in there. And at the very end, because we tried before, but wasn't strategic because we had a problem, but we used our chorus, which was like 50 or something people. Because at the end, where people were starting to get out of the presentation, and we started, you know, singing Jesu meine Freude, which actually increased the response of the people, because there was something, we managed to trigger something human in them. Right? Remember this, like, this academic guy who knows, who's read all these treaties, who's read all this, all that. But there's still a blockage which prevents these people from acting. You've seen these experts, right? They know everything, but when it's time to act, they're always the first one to leave. I gotta go write a book about it, but I'm not gonna do anything. Right? So there's a certain thing that we see in society, which sometimes get people afraid, right? People's reaction sometimes is a bit insane, and when people look at politics, you see something sometimes very depressive and disgusting. You see corruption, you see greed, and you see people who don't care. But if you start bringing this idea of truth and start having a dialogue with those people, which sometimes can take a long time, will actually generate something a lot more human in these people, and they will react just like people like Clinton or Arafat and these people did. They will be forced by the events, but also by leadership, and that's something that Schiller mentioned in the Friedrich Schiller is a German historian and poet. And he wrote a document on the 30 Years' War. And one thing that he mentioned at the beginning, he says, look, despite all that happened, despite all the killing, somehow we still managed to create historical individual. Despite that, we had people who responded to the highest... Basically, the highest universal principles that you could respond to, right? Imagine, like, you have this, because that's the same thing with Rabin and Arafat, right? You're having a dialogue while all this shit is occurring, all the war and, you know, suicide bombing, and there's a lot of reasons to stop it. But then we gotta ask ourselves, who is gonna do it? We're going to just say, okay, well, okay, the youth, they still have another 10 years of rationality, so we'll just let them waste themselves. And maybe later we'll start working with them. Because actually it's quite the opposite. If you look at any revolution, any good revolution, you desperately need the youth. The American Revolution was not made by just old geezer. You had Franklin, Washington, was about, you know, in his 40s, I guess, 50s. But people that were very young, like General Lafayette, was in his very, not even 20. People like Alexander Hamilton, right? Who are people that basically shaped the United States. You had the same thing with people like Carl Friedrich Gauss, who's a mathematician that we're studying here, who was about 19 or 20 years old, who wrote a dissertation basically exposing some of the worst corrupted scientific networks that were basically using sophistry in order to keep people backward. And, you know, you had this kid who just get it out and start, you know, creating a... I mean, he had put his finger on something pretty big. And today is the same thing, right? If we wait for, you know, the same people that are dealing with politics right now, have actually destroyed the potential for real change. If we wait for them to act somehow on a truthful basis, it's not gonna happen. So, and that's why LaRouche started to create this youth movement, saying, okay, let's get these guys to become geniuses. Let's get these guys to master, you know, as many universal principles as possible. on astronomy, you know, economics, philosophy, right, and start spreading those ideas around. And that's how you can generate a healthy society, or at least healthy individuals that will look into changing society. So Rob's class, I think we'll go through one of those economic principles that actually can transcend borders, and that we had in Canada as well. So.